Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, if you love donuts, and who doesn't, I ask, we learn how to make them at home in this week's installment of Food Friday.
But first, this week, the Supreme Court struck down three of President Obama's recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, saying he had overreached by trying to fill the appointments while the Senate was on a brief break.
The ruling comes at a time of partisan gridlock on Capitol Hill, and it was hailed by Republicans who said that they saw the president's move as an abuse of executive power.
Well, what does the ruling mean for presidential powers moving forward? With us now is Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter for Politico. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, good to be with you.
So this week, the Supreme Court checked the president's executive powers when it comes to recess appointments. What did they decide?
Well, the court ruled 9-0, actually, unanimously, that these appointments that President Obama issued, as you mentioned, to the National Labor Relations Board in January of 2012, were unconstitutional. The consensus on the court was that the Senate was basically not in a recess. The president used this power called recess appointment, and it's in the Constitution that when the Senate is in recess, the president can fill certain vacancies in the executive branch and also the judicial branch. But the Supreme Court said that the three-day recess that the Senate was in just wasn't long enough to count for the purposes of the Constitution. The Senate was basically in a vacation break that lasted a few weeks, but was doing something called pro forma sessions, where every few days, one, two, three, a few members of the Senate would come in and basically open the session and close it rather quickly, basically in a mechanism that's used to try to prevent just this thing, just these types of recess appointments. So it was a pretty big defeat for the White House. The court did divide 5-4 on some questions relating to recess appointments. So it wasn't as big of a loss for the White House or as big as a disappointment for those who are arguing in favor of a broader recess appointment power as it could be. But I still think as a practical matter, in the wake of this ruling, it's going to be fairly easy for the Senate to thwart the president from making basically any recess appointments in the future if the Senate's so inclined to do that.
Yeah, the White House was sort of billing this as a good news, bad news sort of scenario. You're saying it's maybe more bad news. Can you give us a sense of why the president was going that route to begin with?
Well, I mean, the reason the president felt that he would consider doing these recess appointments was because of gridlock in the Senate. Now, that brings up something that has changed here. There's been a pretty significant change in the political landscape since this dispute arose two and a half years ago, which is just last fall, the Democrats in the Senate exercised the so-called nuclear option, and that basically expressing frustration with Republicans for holding up both judicial and executive branch nominees. The Democrats changed the Senate rules to require only 50 votes to approve a nomination instead of what was effectively a 60-vote requirement or hurdle before that. That meant that Republicans were no longer needed under the current breakdown of the Senate to get the president's nominees through. So in a sense, this recess appointment case isn't as significant now as it was when it started. It could potentially be a little more significant in the future if the Republicans were to take control of the Senate or if you had a very, very closely divided Senate. But even if the Republicans take control, I'm not sure that this opinion would be that critical. In fact, its primary impact right now might be to provide some political support for Republicans who are complaining that the president sometimes goes too far in exercising his executive powers.
Now, the court was considering stricter rules on these recess appointments that would have made it, you know, even more difficult. Can you tell us a bit about what else was on the table under consideration?
Yeah, so these are pretty technical, but a lower court, the D.C. Circuit, had found that the president's recess appointments were unconstitutional for three separate reasons. One was because, as I mentioned, that it was only a three-day break, and the Senate said it wasn't really in recess. But there were two other reasons. One, the court said that this power only applied to vacancies that occurred during a specific recess. So that would mean if a slot had been open for months or even years, the president couldn't fill it during a recess. You could only fill one that just occurred. You know, if someone died in office or abruptly resigned, the president could move to fill that slot. But any long-term vacancies, he couldn't, and that would obviously be a big problem from a presidential point of view. And so that was one concern. And then the other one was a question of maybe this power applies only during breaks between what's typically the two sessions of the Senate. That could be as much as a year apart. Again, if you took that view, it would really dramatically constrain the president's power. But as I say, I think just by saying that whenever the Senate goes out for 10 days or less, it's not really in recess, the Supreme Court has sort of handed the Senate a way to block future recess appointments. It should also be noted that it's not totally up to the Senate whether it goes into recess. Some people may wonder, well, if it's Democratic controlled, why don't they just go into recess and let the president make some of these nominations? But it turns out that the way the Senate does that as a legal matter and according to legislative rules, it actually needs the consent of the House. And so if the House is controlled by Republicans, they can actually contribute to blocking these kinds of recess appointments as well.
Now, some of the reasons that the court didn't go the stricter route, some of the three you just mentioned there, reasons given were the centuries of history and the traditional practice of presidents in the past that the court didn't want to upset. Justice Breyer, in particular, referring to that. Can you give us a sense of the history that Breyer was referring to?
Well, you know, Breyer is really, I call him sort of an institutionalist. You know, he thinks that the government's long-established traditions should generally be respected unless there's some significant reason to go another way. And he's very reluctant to say that something that's been going on for 200 years in a certain way is actually in violation of the Constitution, which is what the conservative judges on the justices on the Supreme Court concluded. Breyer, writing for the liberals as well as Justice Kennedy, said that in this case there was a history of appointments for decades, if not for centuries, where presidents had filled up various nominations, probably hundreds of them in both the judicial branch and the executive branch during recesses. And most of the time, presidents didn't think that it had to be between a session or that the break had to be officially declared as a recess or anything along those lines. So he felt that allowing presidents to retain that power was in keeping with the traditions. But you need to keep in mind that when the Constitution was written, the recesses, people were probably thinking that Congress would be out of session more often than in session, and that there might be months between congressional sessions because you're talking about people coming by horseback to the Capitol. And it was just a totally different situation from the modern era when, you know, Congress can be called back into session probably on a day's notice if that's necessary.
And there's been this tug of war going on recently between Congress and the president over the use of executive powers. How does this tip the scales?
Well, this does provide one more talking point, one more arrow in the quiver, if you will, for the GOP argument that the president is going too far in wielding his executive power. You know, just a few days ago, we had House Speaker John Boehner come out and say that he planned to file a lawsuit against the president for him overstepping his bounds in various issues, including immigration, including Obamacare, both areas where the president has claimed some unusual, if not unprecedented, authority to ignore aspects of the law or to not enforce certain aspects of the law. That has angered many Republicans. They've been complaining about it for months, and we've seen similar complaints in other spheres. For example, the deal between the Taliban and the Obama administration to turn over five Taliban prisoners in exchange for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl out of Afghanistan. Congress wasn't notified there as required by law. The president said, given the urgency of the matter, he didn't really have to notify Congress or he wasn't going to. And even the NSA issue, I think, has put some legislators in both parties on edge about what they see as sort of uncontrolled, unbridled executive power. It's an interesting complaint for people to be leveling at President Obama, of course, because, you know, he came to office in 2007 and 2008, in many respects, very critical of then-President George W. Bush's use of executive power on a variety of fronts. And now we see President Obama using many of those same powers as he finds himself sort of frustrated with Congress on some of the issues he's concerned about.
And as you mentioned before, the recess appointments had been used by the White House as a way to cut through some of the gridlock. What does this mean for both the Obama White House and future presidents about how to work within that framework that seems so prevalent these days, gridlock?
Well, it means that the president is not going to have as much leverage as he used to in these situations, although we should again take note that if the Senate keeps its 50-vote rule instead of its 60-vote rule, the president still has a pretty wide amount of latitude to try to get those 50 votes. It's probably, again, going to come into play most often when the Senate has fallen into opposition hands, the opposite of the party that's in the White House, and when there are enough senators there that will resist almost anybody the president nominates. That's the kind of resistance we've been seeing, maybe not on every executive branch nomination, but on a lot of judicial nominations we've seen Republicans take sort of a party line approach. And so I think, the president may in some cases have to, in the future, this president or another president might have to nominate some people that are less controversial, that are more moderate, more middle of the road than he or she might be inclined to nominate otherwise, just in order to try to get those people through the Senate. And they won't have this sort of relief valve, if you will, of being able to stick somebody in through a recess appointment, because I think that's probably effectively that door is going to be closed.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Josh, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking to Josh Gerstein, senior White House correspondent for Politico. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. It may seem odd talking about donuts in the summer, but you may be surprised to hear that the fried, tasty treats are popular in all climates, and donuts have quite a history.
President Kennedy once accidentally called himself a donut on a visit to Berlin, and donuts played a vital role in both world wars.
Donuts are also international. There are many delicious variations of the treat. Today on Food Friday, we'll learn more about the donut and how you can make them at home.
With us is Michael Crondell, a food writer, culinary historian, cooking teacher, and artist. He's the author of the book, The Donut: History, Recipes, and Lore from Boston to Berlin. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So the donut sort of seems like this treat for everybody, but it's got this history stretching back thousands of years. Can you tell us when the donut first made its debut?
Well, at some point people figured out that if you fried a hunk of dough that it was tastier than if you baked it, and that probably happened a really long time ago. The ancient Greeks had some sort of fried dough. Certainly the medieval Europeans would celebrate all sorts of occasions by frying dough. It was really only in America that it became kind of an everyday treat rather than a special occasion treat.
So what kind of special occasions did people use donuts for?
Mostly carnival, because to make donuts, you need, especially in European-style donuts, like, jelly donuts type of thing, you need lots of lard. And so after the winter, you'd have all these slaughtered pigs, you'd have all this lard, and then you would have carnival. And what do you do with all that lard? Well, you make donuts, because during carnival, you can't eat the lard for...
So basically, the weather gets warm, people go wild, and they have donuts.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, they would, they would cross-dress, they would do all sorts of illicit activities, and they would eat donuts.
Is that why beignets are popular in New Orleans? And
it may be one reason. Yeah. Or I think just in New Orleans, they know what they're doing.
but donuts aren't just all about going crazy and indulgence, too. There are some situations where it's not sinful. It's actually a religious element, right?
That's right. Hanukkah is traditionally celebrated with donuts. In many Arab and Muslim cultures, during Ramadan, you begin the evening meal, or you sort of end the day's fast by eating some fried dough. There's this long religious association. The funny thing is that, when they came to the United States, they became ordinary. It was in Europe, they had been special occasion treats. There is a medieval poem that talks about a land of plenty where the fences are made with bratwurst and the trees are hung with donuts. And
that sounds like Wisconsin, actually.
It's like Wisconsin.
If you add cheese, that is Wisconsin.
Right, all you need to do. So in America, this was the real deal. This is what they came for. They came for a land, where the fences were made with bratwurst and the trees hung with donuts.
Are there places in the world, Michael, where people love donuts as much as we love them in America? Or is it something that Americans, you know, we have just a special place in our hearts for donuts?
I think we have a special place for excess. You know, lots of countries eat donuts. The Viennese are particularly fond of their donuts. Italians are fond of their donuts. But I don't think anybody has originated, you know, these, well, I know, nobody's originated these massive donut chains, with the one exception being Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Canadians are even more obsessed with donuts, and it may be because the weather in much of Canada is much like it is in Wisconsin.
You know, coffee and donuts go together, that kind of thing?
Sure, on a cold winter's day, or, you know, even on a summer day, who could turn out a fresh donut?
Well, one interesting fact about donuts, you say that it was donuts and not burgers that actually started the whole fast food revolution.
Well, they did, because if you look back into the 1920s and the 30s, there weren't fast food burger joints, but there were fast food donut stores that opened up. There was a company based in New York, which eventually turned into the Donut Corporation of America, and set up a Mayflower chain of donut shops. And then later you had Krispy Kreme, which originates in the 1930s, long before there was, you know, McDonald's or anything like that.
And Mr. Donut?
Sure, Mr. Donut. Well, Mr. Donut was actually a spinoff of Dunkin' Donuts.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The original owner of Dunkin' Donuts had a partner, and they split up at one point, and one ran with the Mr. Donut name.
Wow.
Well, let's talk about how you make donuts, because, you know, you don't have to buy them. You can make them at home. Real quickly, how do you sort of, what's the baseline of making a good donut?
The baseline is having some fat to fry in. Donuts are not difficult to make, but you want to make them for a crowd. You can't make two donuts. So if you're going to make a batch of donuts, make a dozen, make two dozen. Because once you've got the setup, it's easy enough. But getting the setup ready and, you know, dealing with the oil and all that takes a little bit of effort.
So what fat is best to use?
You want a heavy pot. You want to put in about 2 inches of oil, or possibly something like vegetable shortening, or if you want to be really authentic, get yourself some lard.
But only 2 inches. I when I was a kid, we used to make donuts, and we had like a whole...
You have fry daddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can get away with 2 inches. 3 inches, 4 inches is better.
Wow, well, that makes it easier, then.
Yeah, 2 inches you can get away with. Particularly if you make kind of, you know, traditional kind of ring-style donuts, they don't blow up that much.
And then what kind of flour are you using with this?
The flour?
Yeah.
Oh, just regular all-purpose flour mostly. Occasionally cake flour. If you're making cake donuts, cake flour will give you a slightly... more cakey, crumbly, tender consistency. But if you're going to make a yeast donut, you know the difference between a cake donut and a yeast donut, right?
Well, tell me.
Okay.
So, I know it, but like a cake donut is basically like a cake. Yeast is like bread.
Right, exactly. So one has this kind of pulley texture, sort of like a Krispy Kreme typically, right? And the other kind has a crumbly texture, more like a Dunkin' Donuts type donut.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some people like one and some people like the other. The advantage of the cake donut is you can vary the flavors a lot more. The advantage of the yeast donut is it's less greasy. It doesn't absorb as much fat.
And we got to talk about the recipe that you shared with us, one called Nutella Bomboloncini.
Oh, those are so good.
What are those? Can you walk us through the recipe?
Those are a yeast donut. Those are basically a Boston cream, if you want to call it that, or a jelly donut. Except instead of filling them with jelly, you take a piping bag and you insert into the middle and you just fill it with Nutella until it starts oozing out the top.
That can't be bad.
No, they're like crazy good.
And you can do that as a donut hole as well?
You can, if you really want to be abstemious.
And we do have that recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. And I got to say, I have never made donuts. Apparently, Mike has made donuts. They always seem intimidating. Are they hard to make? You mentioned, you know, a couple inches
of
fat.
They're not that bad. I mean, you need a thermometer so you know how hot the fat is. And they're no harder than making a cupcake, really.
We used to make them with, you know, that poppin' fresh dough.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, we'd take the dough and we'd make it donut shaped and we'd fry it.
You know what's funny about that? There's somebody out there trying to sell a biscuit donut. You know the cronut phase?
Yeah,
phase, right? So now they're all trying to come up with new crazes or new kind of recipes that are based on the donut. And apparently there's somebody coming up with a biscuit donut, which is very much what you're describing, right?
Oh, sounds so yummy. Michael, thank you for coming on and talking donuts today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We've been talking to Michael Crondell, food writer, culinary historian, cooking teacher, and artist. He's the author of The Donut, History, Recipes, and Lore from Boston to Berlin. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Last year, a bill was drafted that would have imposed tougher penalties on firearm felonies. It had support from some Republicans and even mild support from some in the gun rights movement, but it was ultimately never introduced.
In a recent piece, our next guest tells the story of the rise and fall of the legislation and what it means for the future of gun laws in Wisconsin. Bill Leaders is with us. He's the Money and Politics Project Director at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Good to be on your excellent show.
So why don't we start off with what this whole bill was about and what the proposed law might have done?
Well, this was a proposal that was announced in August of 2013, just as there had been a spate of shootings in the city of Milwaukee, some 23 shootings within a period of just a couple of weeks, including 7 fatal shootings. A state senator, Republican state senator, Alberta Darling, said she wanted to introduce legislation which would toughen the penalty for felons who commit gun offenses. It would impose a mandatory minimum sentence of 3 years for any individual who committed a felony possession of firearm crime. Mm-hmm. There are penalties now, and they can be substantially higher than that, but they're not mandatory minimums. They can be much less than that in the actual application. This is something that the police chief of the city of Milwaukee, Edward Flynn, has wanted for some time. The city of Milwaukee, through its lobbying arm and through the office of Mayor Barrett, has also called for this and other changes in the law to help address some of the gun violence problems that exist in the city. Walking along comes this Republican state senator, says, I'm going to introduce it. And that was in August of last year.
So things seem to be moving forward. There was support from different people. Even some gun rights people were in support
of it.
Well,
at that point, that wasn't clear. Governor Walker said that he was open to the idea. There drew support from Representative Speaker Robin Voss in the State Assembly. They both said that, Voss actually came on and said he supported it, and Walker kind of said he was supportive of the idea, and as long as it didn't interfere with the rights of law-abiding gun owners, he was open to it. And so it did seem to come into play with a lot of support behind it, and then it kind of faded from view. Mm-hmm. Now, I had written about it at the time that it was introduced, and then it faded from view. And then in May, when this horrible incident happened in the city of Milwaukee, where a 10-year-old girl was shot in the head while playing on the playground by a stray bullet from a couple of people who had gotten into it, and one of them was firing a weapon, I looked back at the bill and tried to find out what I could about what had happened to it. And at that point, the city of Milwaukee said, well, they thought that it may have been circulated for co-sponsorship, meaning that, other lawmakers were asked to join in being sponsors of this legislation, but it was never actually introduced. So,
that happens from time to time with legislation, though, right?
Yeah. Either the feeling is that the support isn't significant enough, isn't great enough, or the people to whom it's circulated will identify problems with the legislation, say, this is really a failing of it. You need to fix this, and for that reason, it's not introduced. So, yeah, it happens often that legislation would be introduced for co-sponsorship and then not actually be introduced. But I didn't know what happened with this bill, and when I asked Senator Darling's office for comment about what happened, they didn't tell me anything. So I was left just with the perspective of some Democrats in the legislature who were saying things like they thought that maybe some of the gun lobby groups put pressure on the senator and she backed down. They were portraying this as a case where maybe the gun lobby flexed its muscle and the senator backed down. Now, that's the only perspective I had at the time that I wrote that column in May. Honestly, it didn't ring true to me. I mean, Senator Darling is not a wallflower. I wouldn't expect that a little bit of pressure would force her knees to buckle. But that was the perspective that was offered. So I made an open records request of Darling's office for all of the correspondence that it had sent and received in connection with this bill.
So, and what did you find out in doing that? You got the records?
Well, it was mainly interesting for what it didn't contain. I mean, there were talking points and there were communications with other officials and there were a few responses to the co-sponsorship memo. And I was able to find out through the other co-sponsor, Democrat John Richards, in the state assembly that a total of 15 additional members of the assembly signed on to this bill, including four Republicans in the assembly. There were four Republicans who were supportive of the bill. And then I was looking through the file, well, where is it that somebody said, good idea, bad idea, you better not do this, I have a concern about it. I didn't find any of that. The only thing that I found along those lines was a email from a gun rights activist in the Milwaukee area, Jim Fendry, who I've actually known for decades as a reporter. He runs a group called Wisconsin Gun Right Movement. And he had written an email just identifying a little bit of concerns that he had with the idea of a felony possession automatically carrying a 3-year mandatory minimum. But he also said in the memo that unless the NRA conveyed to him that they were unhappy with the bill, that he and his organization would not oppose it. And so I called.
Did you talk to the NRA then?
I didn't. I talked to Jim Fendry and followed up on that. And what Jim told me was that, no, the NRA never did oppose it. So far as he knows, it had no opposition from that organization. And further, he said that he thought that this was a bill that could have had, possibly, not certainly, but possibly could have had support from the pro-gun lobby. Because gun lobby, I shouldn't say gun lobby, gun rights activists, I should say, do support the idea of people obeying the law, and they do support the idea of there being penalties for people who disobey it. And this is, it was a type of legislation that they could very possibly have supported, in his view.
Hmm. So then, what does this story tell about the future of gun legislation in Wisconsin?
Well, what it shows is that even though this was a bill that had expressions of support from a Republican governor and the Republican Speaker of the Assembly, and even though it was introduced by a Republican state senator, and even though the gun organizations, the gun rights organizations, didn't oppose it and maybe actually had some sense of support for it, it never gained enough momentum even to be introduced. Hmm. And I think it just was disappointing on some level, probably for the sponsors, that the main sponsors, John Richards and Senator Darling, that more of their colleagues weren't willing to say, yeah, put my name on that bill, I want this to happen. And so it never went anywhere. So I think that was the message of the column, is that when you come to the issue of legislating around guns, that there's a real reluctance on the part of the political structure to do things, even in a circumstance like this where there's pretty much just a series of green lights.
Now, I've done some reading on this in other, you know, newspapers and stuff like that, and it appeared that there were some people who expressed concern that it was really only an issue in Milwaukee and it didn't affect the rest of Wisconsin, and that's why people backed off on support. Did you get any indication of that in any of the?
Yeah, in fact, Jim Fendry made that point too. He said that this is really an issue, the extreme gun violence that is a problem in a few zip codes in Milwaukee.
Right.
The impetus for this legislation came from Milwaukee because of the gun problems that it has. And yes, it would be applied statewide, but what the legislation would do is just impose a mandatory 3-year minimum sentence on people who are in felonious possession of a firearm.
Right. Well, we're going to continue this conversation. Bill Leaders is with us. He's Money and Politics Project Director at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We're talking about this recent piece of gun crime legislation that didn't see the light of day in the state legislature. This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We continue our conversation now with Bill Leaders from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We're talking about his piece on gun crime legislation that had Republican support but never got introduced, and what that story says about gun legislation more generally.
And you can join the conversation right now at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Do you think that there's any possibility that new legislation affecting guns could be passed in Wisconsin? What do you think about gun-related laws? Do you think they should be toughened up to deal with felons who have guns? Are guns now the third rail of politics, and nobody's going to advocate for new laws? We'd like you to join that conversation. Call 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. And why don't we get things started with Ken from Black River Falls. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I was listening to what the purpose of this legislation is. It's a person who is convicted of a felony as an enhancer in terms of sentencing because they were using a gun in the commission of the felony. Am I understanding that right?
Well, they don't have to be using a gun in the commission of the felony. They have to be in felonious possession of a firearm. So if you are a felon and you are caught to be in possession of a gun, that is a felony. You're not allowed to do that. That's against the law. This would say, in that circumstance, you're going away for 3 years.
Well, there's a reason for that. I mean, I'm a criminal defense lawyer, and I understand the reason that people don't want to see guns used in the commission of crimes or to have felons in possession of guns. I mean, it's not like we're trying to punish people who own a gun and helped an old woman across the street against traffic. It doesn't seem like a law that we get a lot of opposition. I'm mystified by the opposition. It actually protects the rights of people like me who have a gun or two, and I'm not a felon, and, you know, want to own a gun because I hunt or do target shooting or trap shooting.
So, Ken, you're an NRA member?
I'm a life member of the NRA.
Yeah. And as somebody with a legal background, are you familiar with these laws in other states or have any thoughts about that?
It's enough to stay up with the laws in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But Jim Fendry is no fool. I think I'd pay attention to him and what he's saying. He's made this his life's work, mm-hmm. and I'm glad that Bill Leaders talked to him. But I always enjoy everything Bill writes, by the way.
But from your position in Black River Falls, do you feel like there could be some value to saying, well, maybe this is just a Milwaukee issue and it shouldn't be a state
law? No, it's not just a I'm not going to. First of all, that almost implies profiling right off the bat. Secondly, I don't think it's just a Milwaukee issue. I mean, I was born in what's called the most dangerous city in the United States, Camden, New Jersey. Yet every city in the United States has a Camden in it, and they have problems. And the problems aren't going to be solved by restricting gun ownership because people who want to own guns are going to own them. But to have this as an enhancer, I suppose, makes sense. The next question is, how do you determine that person owns a gun? What sort of a search are they supposed to be subject to? And what problems do they have there under, say, the Fourth Amendment, the unlawful search and seizure? I don't know.
See, the city of Milwaukee and the chief of police, they want a series of reforms, changes to be enacted to make it illegal for someone who has been, for instance, convicted of 3 misdemeanor offenses within a 5-year period to obtain a concealed carry permit. Right now, you can have as many misdemeanor convictions as you want, not that you'd want them, and still get a concealed carry license. In fact, you can be repeatedly convicted of a misdemeanor crime for being in possession of a firearm without a concealed carry license. You can get 6, 7, 8, 10 criminal convictions for that misdemeanor, and if you apply for a concealed carry license, that would not stop you from getting it.
Well, thanks to Ken for those comments and questions. We really appreciate that. We are talking about gun control legislation in Wisconsin, or gun-related laws in Wisconsin, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And again, I guess we got a sense from that call that there are people who are NRA members and gun owners who think, sure, this is reasonable. How much is
and it may just be that, you know, this is an issue that needs to saturate a little bit into, and I expect that it will be reintroduced. And again, this is not a measure that that people get, pardon the expression, up in arms about. They do seem to accept that if someone is breaking the law, that they should pay the consequences for that.
Yeah, but did you get any sense, or do you have a sense that this is politics related? I mean, maybe we don't want to deal with this kind of stuff when it's an election year, and why don't we hold off? It doesn't necessarily mean that it'll never happen.
Yeah.
It just means it won't happen this year.
I think what this shows is that there is fear even in the absence of threats, that among the political class, that politicians are afraid to be associated with changing gun laws, even in cases where there's not a lot of strong or serious opposition.
800-642-1234 is the number. You can join the conversation. Let's go to, I can't read this. My glasses are kind of weird, but I think it's Abdi from Barron. Abdi, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. So my comment, can you hear me?
Yep, I can.
So my comment is this, you know, someone like me, I don't need a gun. I don't see any need for it. But I'm threatened by the fact that a lot of people are carrying guns in the city, and I'm okay if someone has a gun or two in their house. They should keep those guns in their house, and they should take it out when they have a need for it, like when they have to hunt or when they have to play a gun. But we have some laws in Wisconsin that people cannot carry a gun with them all the time, and humans by nature are a very destructive animals. Let us say someone gets mad and he has a gun or she has a gun, and they get so mad, and then they might kill someone with that gun, and then now they even have some laws that allow them to claim self-defense.
So Abdi, it sounds to me like you would favor some more gun-related laws in Wisconsin then.
So, I mean, my question is, why are gun owners so opposed to gun regulations that allow them to have maybe one or two or three guns? Why are they opposed? That is my question.
Abdi?
That's a good question, whether they are. You know, this issue, the perennially introduced bill that gets nowhere in Wisconsin is the bill that would require background checks for all gun purchases. It didn't even get a hearing when it was introduced this time. If you do public opinion surveys, that bill has overwhelming support by the citizens of the state of Wisconsin, has overwhelming support by gun owners in the state of Wisconsin, has overwhelming support by people who say they are members of the National Rifle Association. In all of those categories, the support is well above 50%, heading to into the 90s. In fact, one of the advocates for gun law changes, Jerry Bonavia, likes to say that the issue of background checks for gun purchases has a higher popularity rating in Wisconsin than Aaron Rodgers.
So why do you think that it, despite that, it doesn't move forward?
Because the decisions about what laws get passed are made by legislators and not by the citizenry. And that's where the disconnect is on this issue, and that it's clear from just the public opinion surveys that there is significant public support for certain kinds of changes in the law that the legislature is not embracing.
But don't they have a sense of responsibility to their constituency, though? I mean, they're politicians. I would think that would sway them to move in that direction.
On an issue like that, there is actual organized and coordinated opposition from certain gun-affiliated groups. The NRA doesn't like the idea of background checks. The NRA fights that. The NRA might fund their opponent. The NRA might try to take them out to make an example of them for having supported this. It's done it in other places. So in there, I mean, if on purely political level, you could argue they are justified in having some concern about what the consequences should they throw their support behind that type of legislation.
Not from their constituents, but from,
not
the,
from, their constituents,
from the interest
though.
Groups.
Yeah. Okay. Their constituents are all for it, if you can trust the surveys.
Well, let's go to another phone call. David from Green Bay. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. I'm just kind of curious, why isn't it mandatory that everybody goes through gun safety course? I mean, has anybody really stared down a bullet? I know I have three times and protected myself. How many people actually get the chance of staring down a bullet and know how to defend themselves?
Well, David, thanks for that call. Bill, it seems like that's another area where, you know, sort of requiring gun owners to go through certain training is something that he suggests would be a good idea, gun safety class.
Yeah, and it's also something I think the majority of gun owners would be supportive. I don't know if they'd be supportive of the idea of a mandatory class, but I think gun owners in general are fairly responsible, and they want people who have and use guns to know what they're doing, and they would be supportive of, you know, at least in concept that people who have guns know how to use them, and they educate themselves, and they take the safety courses. I don't see why that wouldn't have support.
Well, let's go to just one more call. Teresa from Milwaukee. Teresa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Well, two tiny things. I think that Alberta Darling putting this up as an idea is sort of a win-win for her. She never has to vote on it because, you know, darn good and well, it's not going to come to a vote. It's extremely reasonable, so even the rabid people, you know, can say, well, at least there was a reason for that. But she never had to vote. And then a few other people can say, yeah, we go along with it too. So they get the best of both worlds. The other thing I wanted to say is any legislator in a state who says, well, that's a Milwaukee problem, I don't have to care about it, doesn't care about the state. You know, even if it is a Milwaukee problem, why do you want the people of Milwaukee to suffer more? So any legislator who would say something like that is not actually viewing their job appropriately.
Well, and Teresa, thanks for that comment. Bill, final comment on that?
The urgency of this bill and the relevance of this bill is underscored by this 10-year-old girl in Milwaukee who was shot in the head by two convicted felons who are not supposed to be having guns and are not subject to mandatory minimums. That girl was just taken off of life support.
Well, Bill, thanks for joining us. That was Bill Leaders, Money and Politics Project Director at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.